Chapter 16. Benton stared at him with eyes wrinkled by amusement. Perhaps she hadn't disappeared then. Vice disregarded the conjecture. "Oh, look here, I believe all these letters are a hoax," he broke out. Benton stared at him with a face that turned slowly red and angry. "What are you talking about? All what letters? These I've spread out here. I've been comparing them. And I believe they're all written by one man." Burton's redness turned to a purple that made his ruddy mustache seem pale. "W, what the devil are you driving at?" he asked. "Well, just look at it," Vice persisted, still bent above the letters. I've been studying them carefully, those that have come within the last 2 or 3 weeks, and there's a queer likeness in the writing of some of them. The GS are all like corkscrews. And the same phrases keep recurring. The Ann Arbor news agent uses the same expressions as the president of the girls' college at Euphorbia, Maine. Benton laughed. "Aren't the critics always groaning over the shrinkage of the national vocabulary? Of course we all use the same expressions." "Yes," said Vice obstinately. "But how about using the same GS? Benton laughed again, but Vice continued without heeding him. "Look here, Benton, could Strett have written them?" "Strett?" Benton roared. "Strett?" He threw himself into his armchair to shake out his mirth at greater ease. "I'll tell you why. Strett always posts all my answers. He comes in for them every day before I leave. He posted the letter to the misunderstood party, the letter from you, that the dead letter office didn't return. I posted my own letter to her, and that came back." A measurable silence followed the emission of this ingenious conjecture. Then Benton observed with gentle irony, "Extremely neat. And of course it's no business of yours to supply any valid motive for this remarkable attention on my valet's part." Vice cast on him a slanting glance. "If you found that human conduct's generally based on valid motives, well, outside of madhouses it's supposed to be not quite incalculable." Vice had an odd smile under his thin mustache. "Every house is a madhouse at some time or another." Benton rose with a careless shake of the shoulders. "This one will be if I talk to you much longer," he said, moving away with a laugh. Benton did not for a moment believe that Vice suspected the valet of having written the letters. Why the devil don't he say out what he thinks? He was always a tortuous chap, he grumbled inwardly. The sense of being held under the lens of Vice's mute scrutiny became more and more exasperating. Benton, by this time, had squared his shoulders to the fact that Abundance was a failure with the public. A confessed and glaring failure. The press told him so openly, and his friends emphasized the fact by their circumlocutions and evasions. Benton minded it a good deal more than he had expected, but not nearly as much as he minded Vice's knowing it. That remained the central twinge in his diffused discomfort. And the problem of getting rid of his secretary once more engaged him. He had set aside all sentimental pretexts for retaining Vice. But a practical argument replaced them. If I ship him now, he'll think it's because I'm ashamed to have him see that I'm not getting any more letters. For the letters had ceased again, almost abruptly, since Vice had hazarded the conjecture that they were the product of Strett's devoted pen. Benton had reverted only once to the subject to ask ironically, "A day or two later, is Strett writing to me as much as ever?" And, on Vice's replying with a neutral head shake, had added with a laugh, "If you suspect him, you might as well think I write the letters myself." "There are very few today," said Vice, with his irritating evasiveness. And Benton rejoined squarely, "They'll stop soon. The book's a failure." A few mornings later he felt a rush of shame at his own tergiversations, and stalked into the library with Vice's sentence on his tongue. Vice started back with one of his anemic blushes. I was hoping you'd be in. I wanted to speak to you. There have been no letters the last day or two," he explained. Benton drew a quick breath of relief. The man had some sense of decency then. He meant to dismiss himself. I told you so, my dear fellow. The book's a flat failure, he said, almost gaily. Weiss made a deprecating gesture. I don't know that I should regard the absence of letters as the ultimate test. But I wanted to ask you if there isn't something else I can do on the days when there's no writing. He turned his glance toward the book-lined walls. Don't you want your library cataloged? He asked insidiously. Had it done last year, thanks. Benton glanced away from Weiss's face. It was piteous how he needed the job. I see. Of course this is just a temporary lull in the letters. They'll begin again as they did before. The people who read carefully read slowly. You haven't heard yet what they think. Benton felt a rush of puerile joy at the suggestion. Actually, he hadn't thought of that. There was a big second crop after diadems and faggots, he mused aloud. Of course. Wait and see, said Weiss confidently. The letters in fact began again more gradually, and in smaller numbers. But their quality was different, as Weiss had predicted. And in two cases Benton's correspondence, not content to compress into one rapid communication the thoughts inspired by his work, developed their views in a succession of really remarkable letters. One of the writers was a professor in a Western college, the other was a girl in Florida. In their language, their point of view, their reasons for appreciating abundance, they differed almost diametrically, but this only made the unanimity of their approval the more striking. The rush of correspondence evoked by Benton's earlier novel had produced nothing so personal, so exceptional as these communications. He had gulped the praise of Iodums and Faggots as undiscriminatingly as it was offered. Now he knew for the first time the subtler pleasures of the palate. He tried to feign indifference, even to himself, and to Weiss he made no sign. But gradually he felt a desire to know what his secretary thought of the letters, and, above all, what he was saying in reply to them. And he resented acutely the possibility of Weiss's starting one of his clandestine correspondences with the girl in Florida. Weiss's notorious lack of delicacy had never been more vividly present to Benton's imagination, and he made up his mind to answer the letters himself. He would keep Weiss on, of course. There were other communications that the secretary could attend to. And, if necessary, Benton would invent an occupation. He cursed his stupidity in having betrayed the fact that his books were already catalogued. Weiss showed no surprise when Benton announced his intention of dealing personally with the two correspondents who showed so flattering a reluctance to take their leave. But Benton immediately read a criticism in his lack of comment, and put forth, on a note of challenge: after all, one must be decent. Weiss looked at him with an evanescent smile. Why, you'll have to explain that you didn't write the first answers. Benton halted. I more or less dictated them, didn't I? Oh, virtually, they're yours, of course. You think I can put it that way? Why not? The secretary absently drew an arabesque on the blotting pad. Oh, of course they'll keep it up longer if you write yourself, he suggested. Benton blushed, but faced the issue. Hang it all, I shan't be sorry. They interest me. They're remarkable letters. And Weiss, without observation, returned to his writings. The spring, that year, was delicious to Benton. His college professor continued to address him tersely but cogently at fixed intervals, and twice a week 8 serried pages came from Florida. There were other letters too. He had the solace of feeling that at last abundance was making its way, was reaching the people who, as Weiss said, read slowly because they read intelligently. But welcome as were all these proofs of his restored authority, they were but the background of his happiness. His life revolved for the moment about the personality of his two chief correspondents. The professor's letters satisfied his craving for intellectual recognition, and the satisfaction he felt in them proved how completely he had lost faith in himself. He blushed to think that his opinion of his work had been swayed by the shallow judgments of a public whose taste he despised. Was it possible that he had allowed himself to think less well of Bundance because it was not to the taste of the average novel reader? Such false humility was less excusable than the crudest appetite for praise. It was ridiculous to try to do conscientious work if one's self-esteem were at the mercy of popular judgments. All this the professor's letters delicately and indirectly conveyed to Benton, with the result that the author of Abundance began to recognize in it the ripest flower of his genius. But if the professor understood his book, the girl in Florida understood him. And Benton was fully alive to the superior qualities of discernment which this process implied. For his lovely correspondent, his novel was but the starting point, the pretext of her discourse. He himself was her real object, and he had the delicious sense, as their exchange of thoughts proceeded, that she was interested in Abundance because of its author, rather than in the author because of his book. Of course, she laid stress on the fact that his ideas were the object of her contemplation, but Benton's agreeable person had permitted him some insight into the incorrigible subjectiveness of female judgments, and he was pleasantly aware, from the lady's tone, that she guessed him to be neither old nor ridiculous. And suddenly he wrote to ask if he might see her. The answer was long in coming. Benton fumed at the delay, watched, wondered, fretted, then he received the one word possible. He wrote back more urgently, and awaited the reply with increasing eagerness. A certain shyness had kept him from once more modifying the instructions regarding his mail, and Stretz still carried the letters directly to Weiss. The hour when he knew they were passing under the latter's eyes was now becoming intolerable to Benton, and it was a profound relief when the secretary, suddenly advised of his father's illness, asked permission to absent himself for a fortnight. Weiss departed just after Benton had dispatched to Florida his second missive of entreaty, and for 10 days he tasted the furtive joy of a first perusal of his letters. The answer from Florida was not among them. But Benton said to himself he's thinking it over, and delay, in that light, seemed favorable. So charming, in fact, was this phase of sentimental suspense, that he felt a start of resentment when a telegram apprised him one morning that Weiss would return to his post that day. Benton had slept later than usual, and, springing out of bed with the telegram in his hand, he learned from the clock that his secretary was due in half an hour. He reflected that the morning's mail must long since be in, and, too impatient to wait for its appearance with his breakfast tray, he threw on a dressing gown, and went to the library. There lay the letters, half a dozen of them. But his eye flew to one envelope, and as he tore it open a warm wave rocked his heart. The letter was dated a few days after its writer must have received his own. It had all the qualities of grace and insight to which his unknown friend had accustomed him, but it contained no allusion, however indirect, to the special purport of his appeal. Even a vanity less ingenious than Benton's might have read in the lady's silence one of the most familiar motions of consent, but the smile provoked by this inference faded as he turned to his other letters. For the uppermost bore the superscription "E'd Letter Office," and the document that fell from it was his own last letter from Florida. Benton studied the ironic noun for an appreciable space of time, then he broke into a laugh. He had suddenly recalled Weiss's similar experience with Esther Macklin, and the light he was able to throw on that obscure episode was searching enough to penetrate all the dark corners of his own adventure. He felt a rush of heat to the ears. Catching sight of himself in the glass, he saw a red, ridiculous, congested countenance, and dropped into a chair to hide it between flushed fists. He was roused by the opening of the door, and Weiss appeared on the threshold. "Oh, I beg pardon, you're ill?" said the secretary. Benton's only answer was an inarticulate murmur of derision. Then he pushed forward the letter with the imprint of the dead letter office. "Look at that," he jeered. Weiss peered at the envelope and turned it over slowly in his hands. Benton's eyes, fixed on him, saw his face decompose like a substance touched by some powerful acid. He clung to the envelope, as if to buy in time. "It's from the young lady you've been writing to at Swayze Springs?" he asked at length. "It's from the young lady I've been writing to at Swayze Springs." "Well, I suppose she's gone away," continued Weiss, rebuilding his countenance rapidly. "Yes, and in a community numbering perhaps 175 souls, including the dogs and chickens, the local Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.